Good afternoon, everyone, and a very warm welcome to you. This is John Campbell on Miracle Hour on bbsradio.com on Tuesday at noon here in beautiful British Columbia. And a warm welcome to our listeners all over the world for this hour where it's a great pleasure for me to have guests on who I've come across on my miracle journey. And they share their miracles that they've experienced in their journey of awakening. And about 2 years ago, I guess, I think I may have shared a bit of this, but Mary and I decided to go and have a little retreat. And I Googled for a retreat center on British Columbia, and up popped this name, Xenia, on an island called Bowen Island, which I'd never heard of, didn't know where it was or anything like that. Anyway, Mary was on a course at the time, and I just took a plunge and I booked in. And when she came off the course, we got in the car and we got across on the ferry to this Bowen Island. And as the ferry arrived in a place called Snug Cove, it's a beautiful name, we just fell in love with this place the second we docked. And we went to the retreat center called Xenia, beautiful, beautiful retreat center. And the owner was away, actually, at the time, and we were shown around by the lady that ran the place, administrator, and eventually were told that the owner would be back in a couple of days. And when she came back, we went up there and met with her and her husband, and she was from England, my home country. And we started to talk, and I said, "Where are you from?" And she said, "Oh, well, just a little place, you probably wouldn't have heard of it." And I said, "Well, try me." And she said, "Oh, it's called Cookfield, Crawley and Cookfield." And I said, "Oh my God, and this is the very place where three of my children were born, in the same hospital as this lady." And anyway, we made an instant contact. Mary and I both loved her, and still do. And it's a very great pleasure for me to introduce her on the show today. Her name is Angeline Toft, and she's talking to us today from that beautiful retreat center on Xenia. So good morning, or good afternoon, Angeline. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, John. I'm doing great today, and thanks so much for having me on this call, because I love the title of it, Miracles, Miracle Hour.
Yeah, it's
wonderful.
Yeah, and it was a miracle, Angeline, because so many things, you know, we were going through a lot of things in our life at the time, as you know, and I know that both Mary and I will always be eternally grateful for the time we spent, which was a very healing time over there. It was very much needed for both of us, and you created a wonderful space there, and, you know, getting to know all the people there on Bowen, and you know, with the beautiful horses and Charlie the pig, and, and you know, it was a wonderful time. So what I'd like to do today, as I do with all my guests, is to get you to tell our listeners a little bit about your journey, where you came from, and, you know, how you got onto this path of awakening, and, you know, in your own words, let's bring us up to date, if you would.
Well, okay. Let's see. Well, I began in Cookfield Hospital, a little tiny village in Sussex, England, and I think the first thing, really, I grew up with this passion for horses. And so by age six, I was driving my parents crazy about, I have to be with horses. I have to see horses. And by the age of 19, I was working for the RSPCA in England. And I was working for the head veterinary officer for the area in head office in Horsham. And he said to me, you know, the greatest education you can have is to travel. And I thought, ooh, that really resonated. And I had a very hard decision to make because I have my own horse. And so for me to leave the country was a very painful thing in regards to, you know, my horse, what to do. Anyway, I found a way to leave England without having any money. I didn't really have any money, but I found a way through this process called Camp America, where they, you go through this quite stringent interview, and if you're accepted, then you work in their summer camps for 3 months, and then you travel for 3 months, and then they send you back. So through this process of letting go of my horse and moving on and finding myself in New York, that was a very scary culture shock. and I actually didn't leave my hotel room for 3 days because there were like 8 chains on the door in the hotel room, and I'm like, and policemen had guns. You know, it was a real complete culture shock, and I end up in Buffalo Greyhound Terminal at 1 a.m. And anyway, long story.
What age were you then, Angelina?
I was 19.
18?
19.
19,
and
wow.
I was very innocent and, you know, naive, very
yeah.
for sure. So I did that, had an incredible experience at the camps, and I got my, I got my whole world open up to this place called North America, and, you know, wow. And then I traveled, went back to England and traveled extensively through Europe, came into Canada, was going to travel through Canada and then go to Australia and then head back to England. But long story short, I ended up in Vancouver, Canada, on this west coast, ran out of money, and ended up, you know, it's been 30-odd years, what am I, 32 now? So since 19 to now, I have been here in Vancouver. So that's how I got here. And the awakening process has happened through some pretty serious, I would call them dark night of the souls, or 2x4s across the head, of which I've had, you know, I would say at least 2 or 3 significant ones in my life that have led me to a deeper, deeper journey inwards into the source of my true nature. So that's, you know, the student that I have been has been through the experience of life rather than a particular spiritual practice.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so was it sort of that old adage about when the pain of staying the same gets bigger than the fear of change, we change.
We do, and you know, I don't even know if it's that you know, I made it happen or if it was just it was the time, because I couldn't withstand the pain any longer, and
yeah.
So surrendering. And one of the times actually that really showed me how to. Should I share that piece about, you know, the dark night of the soul around Xenia?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. But that's, I mean, if I could say, that sounds like that's a way bit down. I mean, what happened before?
Okay, let's go, yeah. So,
didn't you work with Tony Robbins for a while?
Yes, I worked way back, you know, way before Tony Robbins became the guru that he is today. I say that lightly, but... yeah, I've got a lot of respect for, you know, I remember when he was just talking about he's going to do this big-time thing, and I stayed at his place down in California, and he was driving this old little rusty what are they called? Those little
GBGT.
One of those little kind of convertible cars, and he had debt collectors coming after him and this and that. But, you know, I always knew he is going to make it big. He's definitely going to make it big, and he did. You know, he really did, and I know his journey's been a big one in the world. So that was way back in my 20s, and I had some adventures, relationship adventures that, you know, kind of an abusive relationship that was very hard with a man quite a bit older than myself, and, you know, again, more awakenings, more. Moving out of that victim position, because I was a true, you know, I really thought I was the victim of this man's aggressiveness, and went through that journey. And I guess the journey leading to getting the retreat center, many people say to me, well, how on earth did you get Xenia? It's a beautiful 38-acre paradise on Bowen Island, sandwiched between two lakes. And it is quite something. It's worth a lot of money, and people say, how did you do that? Well, it's another interesting story. What I did was, for a number of years, maybe 9 or 10 years prior to this, of actually receiving this land, I had a vision, or I should say a vision had me. You know, it's not like I had the vision. It followed me around, and I didn't know why, because I didn't have the money to buy this. But I could see in my mind's eye this beautiful, like, 40 acres. It was a beautiful sanctuary where the inner child could feel safe to be creative. That was the kind of the purpose, the mission, and I could see animals wandering around. I could see trees. I could see like big ropes for playing and art. And I kept thinking, I have no idea why this vision is following me around because I don't have the money to buy something like that. So that was kind of haunted me for a long, long time. And even if I did have the money, I didn't have a clue about how to do a business. So I kept ignoring it and pushing it away, but I could see it as clear as day. So then I went through a real tragedy, and my daughter, who at the time was 5 years old, her father died. My husband died. And it was a very sudden death, and it was, you know, very, very a shock to us all. But prior to him dying, I had separated from him when my daughter was one. And John has asked me to share this story because it is quite intimate and vulnerable to share. But I'll share it because if one person out there can learn from this, you know, it's worth it. It's worth sharing it. But basically what happened when my daughter was one, I separated from her dad through a bunch of, you know, there were reasons. But 2.5 years later, I was involved in another relationship and very, very happy. Thought I was with my soulmate and, you know, it was wonderful. And I was in Breitenbusch at a retreat, and I got a very strong message. I'll call it message on this show. I think I can do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. It was a very strong message. You have to go back with your husband. So I was like, I don't think so. Anyway, this message kind of followed me around every day for a week that we were there. Just, it was gentle. It was just a gentle. It wasn't even, this is an idea. It was just kind of like instructions. And I tried to ignore it. And then when I came back to Vancouver, I was sitting in a restaurant locally in town, and I got it again. And so finally, I told my boyfriend at the time, you know, this may sound insane, but I have to go back with my husband. And he said, you know, why? And I said, well, because I got this very strong message. And he said, oh, in Breitenbusch, right? And I said, yeah. And I told him, and he said, well, he got the same message. But he said, well, you don't have to. You don't have to follow that. That's, you know, insane. You can choose. And I said, I don't know why, but I know I have to follow that. So anyway, it was very hard for both of us, and I did let go of him lock, stock, and barrel, and I got back with my husband, who was very open to that at the time, and we uprooted my daughter again, and, you know, a lot of my friends wouldn't speak to me. They said, you're nuts. Nothing has changed. You're crazy. Why would you do that? And I said, I have no idea. I just know I have to follow instruction. I don't know why. It doesn't make sense. It's crazy. But anyway, went back, and it was 3 months and 12 hours later. So within that 3 months, it was really, really difficult. And some of the same things that had happened before happened again. And it was crazy. It was, you know, silly. And I kept losing doubt and I moved into kind of a little bit of a mini depression. Like, what am I doing? Nothing made sense. So 3 months and 12 hours later, I was really, really depressed, and I went to this muffin break, I remember. I had a muffin and a latte and came out feeling really more depressed. And I pulled to the side of the road, and this whole rap song came, and I wrote it down and while the car was still running. And one day I'll share that with you, John. It was amazing. But I got You Can Let Go Now 3 months, 12 hours later. So what? So anyway, I let go. You know, I uprooted my daughter again, and I lost trust in myself and lost faith in my ability to listen to truth within. So over the next few months, you know, I ended the relationship, and we just moved on, my daughter and I. And 1 year later, well, just short of a year, a few weeks short of a year later, my husband died, and it was a tragedy. It was a shock, and it was, we just had no idea. And so there was a couple of years of just going through, oh my God, you know, the pain of it, and for my daughter and everything, a lot of pain and shock and working through the legal and all of that. But what then became really clear to me which I had no idea of, is there was money coming to me, and we had already separated our financials. So there, you know, I didn't think anything was kind of outstanding, but it turns out there was quite a bit of money. And what the lawyers told me, the lawyers said, if you hadn't gone back for 3 months, it would have been like a 4-year separation, and under the court system or whatever, it would have been treated as a divorce. But because I had gone back for those 3 months, it kind of separated the 3 years or the 2.5 years that came prior to that, and it was now a 1-year separation and regarded, and I was fully and completely regarded as his wife, and everything came to me. Things I didn't even have a clue we had, but what that allowed me to do was buy this retreat center on Bowen Island that, in, you know, how would I ever have known? It's kind of a wild kind of story, but 2 or 3 or 4 lawyers spoke to me about that afterwards, and I realized, and in that moment, I understood radical trust. I knew then, and I've written a book that I haven't quite finished yet, but it's called Radical Trust, and I know now when I get instructions like that, don't bother trying to fight it. Don't even ask questions. Just know that you are being guided at the deepest core level. Because obviously this retreat center, this sanctuary that we've now been in for 13 years, and thousands of people have had profound healing by being here, because the land is it feels like very sacred land. That could never have happened if I hadn't gone back for those 3 months, if I ignored that quiet, you know, gentle nudging of spirit to align all of that. So, John, that was a really vivid example of how I started to learn radical trust.
Mm, that's amazing. That really is an amazing story, Angeline. And I guess it's tough, isn't it? Because so many of us know these things at a cognitive level. We know them, but it's about actually acting on them, isn't it?
Well, that's it, and I think that's where I'm 100% committed now in my life. In whatever I'm doing, that's my journey. I'm 100% obedient to that. And sometimes people say to me, well, or how can I tell the difference between the mind, you know, the ego telling me what to do,
and spirit?
And, you know, that's a very good question, and it's almost difficult to explain, except for when you get it from that deep knowing, you just... No, it's so different. You just know, and it also is where the body wants to naturally move. It's almost like you don't even have to worry about it, because that's what is going to move through us anyway. But whether we have the cognitive understanding of it or not is another story.
And that is a question which, I mean, I've often asked, and so many people, you know, well, how can I tell the difference? And I wish I could hear messages, and there's so many people out there, you know, been fortunate and written books and channeled and all the rest of it. But it is a question which often gets me. But I think the first thing that I've found is I've got to get my mind still. If I hope to really want to listen to spirit, I've got to get my mind still. And so many of us, me included, you know, get such a chatterbox mind, so busy with...
Oh, we get busy. You know, it's a busy society. We're busy, 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 busy. And the beauty of that we call it that voice or that message, the beauty of it is it doesn't matter how much chaos is going on, it is there, and it sits at the place of the true nature of who we are. It's the silence that's within us that can start to arise. And again, you can ignore it, but in fact the ego wants to ignore it, but it will rise up and tell us 2 or 3 times, you know, there'll be that gentle nudge, and it doesn't give up on us, but we give up on it many times.
I think the other thing that I found anyway, because I had the same voice that was telling me to leave my marriage, you know, and it was persistent, you know, and the other thing, that it was there and it was gentle. I remember you saying just earlier that it was a gentle, and that's the thing that I found. It was very gentle. It wasn't commanding, it wasn't demanding, it was very gentle, and it was, you know, you must do this, you must do that. It wasn't I.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other thing I noticed was it was there, even though it was telling me it was time to move on and leave a long, long marriage of 27 years, it was there even when things on the surface appeared to be quite calm within the relationship.
Yeah, and that's always a drag because, you know, I think as a society we tend to only make a change if it's chaotic, if it's bad, if it's painful. When you get a gentle nudging and it, things are kind of, quote, you know, we're quite in our comfort zone, we're quite happy, things are okay, things are doable. And when we get a strong, you know, when we get a knowing or a guidance from that level, that's sometimes a little harder to listen to.
You mean when everything's calm?
Yeah, when everything's kind of going along okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, that's right, like your situation where you were in what seemingly was a wonderful relationship and then you got this message to go back. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, no, it's one of those, it is a difficult part. Anyway, I found difficult to listen in, but I think that's the secret of trying to get still on a regular basis.
Yeah, of course, if we can tune in, and a great way to tune in, if you don't, you know, have a spiritual practice or a meditation practice, I just go and hang out with a tree or the pig or a horse, and they're just so in presence. They're not even trying. They just are present. And you just sit with them and let it be contagious.
Yeah.
And if you're in the city, you know, just sit down in a park or something and allow it, you know, allow yourself to fall into it, because really nature, I think, is our greatest kind of a portal, you could say, or helper.
It is indeed. And and I think the other thing is, so what, when you eventually then, you bought Xenia, what was it when you bought it? I mean...
and again, people thought I was insane here as well. I bought... Because, you see, I saw the vision. It had followed me for at least 8 or 9, 10 years prior to this. So then I was already living on Bowen Island, and I thought, well, if I'm going to buy this 40 acres in my brain that's following me around, it's going to have to be in Fort Saint somewhere or the boondock. You know, it would have to be far, far away, because where am I going to get 40 acres on Bowen Island? First of all, you don't get parcels of land, and the realtors told me, no, every 20 years, if you're lucky, you'll get, you know, a parcel of land like that. But there was, you know, nothing on the market. And but I loved Bowen Island, and I knew something about Bowen Island would be, you know, very precious. So I started asking the real estate agents on Bowen Island to take me to places. So they took me, and for the money that I had to put down and everything, they took me to 2-acre places. So I went to a variety of 2-acre bed and breakfasts and this, that, and the other. But, you know, in my heart, I couldn't reconcile the vision. It was like, no, it's got land. It's got horses. So I kept, you know, saying no. And then one day she phoned me out of the blue, and she said, Angeline, there's a place I have to take you to. It's not on the market yet, and it's not very professional. No, she didn't say that right away. I'll tell you. That's right. She said, but don't ask any questions. Just come. So I was very intrigued, and I said, oh, sure. So she brought me to this place, and as we drove down the road, I could feel my cells tingling, like, uh-huh, you found it. Here we are. And we drove kind of down to this old, broken-down old sheep farm. And I said to her, how many acres? She said, 38. I said, 38 acres on Bowen Island, and how much? And she told me, and it was about 3 times the amount that I was planning on. And I said, and why are you bringing me here and torturing me? Because this feels right. She said, look, I don't know why, and I know it's unprofessional of me because it's not what you're asking for. But however, you did share your vision with me, and I felt compelled to bring you here. So, you know, I thanked her for that and looked around. And honestly, it was a wreck of a place. John, you've seen some of the before pictures, you know. It was quite a mess. And I did, over the next, you know, I thought, oh, okay, well, she's brought me here. There might be a reason. So I went to task to find out who could help me with this financially. So I shared it with, I brought doctors and some investors here. And they pretty much laughed at me, like, oh, God, what are you thinking of? You know, this is not really conducive. So nobody could really see what I could see, which was kind of superimposed over the rubble. I could see the potential. And a lot of people came and like, no way. And I went to the bank, and the bank pretty much said to me, well, you know, where's your business plan? And I said, well, look, I don't have a business plan, but I know it's supposed to happen. And they just pretty much laughed me out of the bank. You know, it was quite funny. So a year later, and in the end I gave up, like, you know, well, who do you think you are anyway? Because even if you can find the money, I mean, what do you know about building, you know, renovating? Nothing. You know, what do you know about retreat centers? Nothing. So forget it. So I did forget it, but my heart was kind of heavy, and I found myself drawn back to the land. I had a very strong connection to the land, so I would go, I'd kind of sneak in and sit up on the land and just be there. But ultimately, I thought, well, I've got to let it go. So then I went to see, Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer. They were doing a double stage. They shared the stage at the Pan Pacific in Vancouver, and I can't remember the exact year. I think it was 93 and or 94. Actually, it was probably 94. And I saw them, and it was something that Deepak said. He said, and, you know, and it really stayed with me. He said that there's something that you do, and if you can find, you know, that you do really, really, really well. Like, you do it so well that you could barely even know it's a talent, but it's something that you do, and you do it better than anybody else, kind of something to that degree. And he said, and if you can find out what that is and do it, you will be fulfilled. That's what he said. And I remember the very next morning, I'm walking around Killarney Lake, and that lake backs onto the retreat center here, onto Xenia. But at the time, of course, it wasn't called Xenia. So I was sitting on that bench on the boardwalk, and I was just kind of, it had been 2 years since my husband had died, and I thought, well, and I'd been going through a lot of legal stuff and this and that. So I thought I said out loud, what I wanted to say was, I need a job. Should I go back to the corporate world? What should I do? But what came out of my mouth as I sat there on the bench by myself was, how may I be of service? And I kind of thought, that's a funny thing to say, you know, when I was thinking about a job. But what came out, how may I be of service? And immediately I heard, buy the land behind you and begin the sanctuary. And at that point, I was so mad. I stomped off the boardwalk. And as I stepped right off the end of the boardwalk, I remember feeling this very strong knowing that it was going to happen. And I was mad. I said, look, I've been trying for a year. And if you want me to do this, you better show me how. And within 12 weeks, I had the thing signed, sealed, and delivered under my name.
Wow.
Yeah. And in 1 year, the price had dropped about $160,000. And I found somebody at the bank, this woman, I'll never forget her. She saw my vision, and she says, okay, I'll give you the mortgage. And she said, but you better probably get about a $50,000 more because you'll have legal costs. I mean, I didn't even know what to ask for, right? And I said, oh, you're going to give it to me? She says, yes. And that there began this land, and that was in 1994.
So, and then this time it was still a broken-down sheep farm.
Yeah, it was a wreck. Well, see, what happened, I was completely in bliss. I was in the honeymoon period for 3 months, you know, that kind of famous three-month period of time. It's funny. And I was just kind of musing around and looking around and had people come over, and I think they just humored me and thought, oh dear, poor girl, anyway. But my dad came over from England, and he looked around and he said, and I remember, never forget this, he had his head in his hands, you know, he kind of bowed down with it. He said, Angeline, oh my God, what have you done? And I'm like, oh, what do you mean, what have I done? Because, of course, I'm still seeing the potential in the view. Well, as soon as he said that, it was as if the veil was removed, and then all I could see was the debris, the rubble, and the, oh my God, what have I done? So I went into a serious decline, like, oh my God, what have I done, what have I done? And I went into a big doubt. And then another miracle, speaking of miracles, John, another miracle happened because the lady that sold me the land, I did share my vision with her. I asked the real estate agent that I said I'd like to meet her. And so she arranged a tea with the lady that owned the place. And her husband and my husband died at the same time. And she was very taken by my vision of this center. So, but I didn't have any kind of relationship with her. But I'll never forget, I called for a meeting of experts to come to my house on Bowen Island. Experts, people that were, you know, marketers, business owners, real professionals, so they could tell me what to do. And the more they started to tell me what to do, the more in overwhelm I became. And I'll never forget going to bed that night feeling so overwhelmed because I thought I had to do this all by myself. I'm going to have to paint, do the renovations, make the beds, do the marketing, do the, you know. I just,
yeah.
For some reason, I just felt so, it's me doing it all. And I'd lost touch with, you know, the truth. So the more they told me, and so I went to bed that night going, oh, my God, I have to sell this place. It was a serious mistake, and who do I think I am? Just like, you know, what have I done? So I woke up the next morning just feeling so sick to my stomach, thinking I'd have to sell it. When I got a phone call from the lady that had sold me the land, not the realtor, but the owner, and I was so shocked. It was like 10 to 11, and she says, so, Angeline, how's your vision coming along? How's your plan coming along? And I was so shocked to hear from her, you know, and I said, funny that you should call me right now, but I'm actually on overwhelm, and I think I've made a very big mistake. And so she said, well, may I ask you a personal question? And I said, well, of course you can. And she said, do you believe in a higher intelligence? That was the exact word she used. And I said, oh. And suddenly then I remembered, like, oh, yes, I thought I had to do this. And so she said, all you have to do is get clear and everything will be provided. And I thanked her and we hung up the phone, and it wasn't until last year, 13 years later, or this year, 13 years later, that I ever spoke to her again. And I invited her out, but I'm jumping ahead again, John.
That's okay.
But yeah, that was it. So that, from that moment on, I never looked back. And I'm not saying it was always easy, but I didn't look back. I just said, okay. And I got back in touch with the truth, which is, it's not me doing this. It's moving through me, and everything will be provided, and it has been.
Yeah.
And it has been literally a miracle.
Yeah.
One miracle after another.
Yeah.
So if anyone has a vision out there, you know, if you have a vision, a dream, or you know you've come to deliver something to the world, and it doesn't even have to be grandiose. It can be something even very simple.
Yeah.
Just go for it.
Yeah, I think that's the important part, and it's interesting that what you said that you heard Deepak say, because I remember reading that in his little book, The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. You know, he said that everyone comes with a specific gift that gives them the ability to do something that nobody else can do as well as they can, you know.
Right.
And that's our job, is to find that out. And isn't that the truth? And also, doesn't that highlight, you know that one of our passions is re-education, you know, changing re-education. And
yeah.
If that were only given to the kids as soon as they stepped into those establishments, instead of trying to follow some set, you know, routine, just to keep that in the focus all the time while they did other stuff, was, you know, finding your passion, finding what you know really makes your heart sing and doing it.
Instead of following rules and that's why the children of today, look at all the learning quote disabilities that they're speaking of, and the children that are very, very blessed with intuitive, and they're very developed, they're very conscious, very awake.
Yeah.
They can't they don't do well in the regular school system.
Absolutely, and that's the part that's frustrating, because they're looked upon as having, what do they call it, learning...
disabilities or whatever.
Disabilities, you know, and really they're learning attributes, you know, they just learn, they have higher or different ways of accessing information, you know, much more evolved, put it that way.
They're our teachers.
Yeah.
It's just that we're not looking at them that way. We're looking at them trying to straighten them out in an old consciousness model.
That's it. And in the process, of course, so many of them actually get those gifts shut down. That's tragedy. That's what I find is the tragedy.
That's the sad part.
Yeah.
And they look, what they need cheerleaders. They need people out there. And you can be an aunt or a friend or they, you know, I really believe that we all have to be witnessed by one other person on the planet to ignite our flame. And ultimately, we have to do that for ourselves. But, you know, kids, we would expect parents to do it or teachers, but that invariably doesn't happen. So to give the gift of witnessing that one other person and just letting them know that you see them.
That's it. That's exactly, I totally agree with that. You know, everyone needs one benevolent witness, I call them.
Yeah.
Who sees who they are, who sees, you know, what they stand for and recognizes them, and that's all they need. And you're absolutely right. It's very, very rare for it to be a family member or a teacher, you know. It can mm-hmm. be somebody just on the periphery of their life, and it doesn't need to be someone who has a large presence in their life.
No.
It's just they need that one connection, and then it's almost like locked to the cellular level, isn't it?
Yeah, the spark of light, the candle has been lit.
That's it.
At that point. But I think people... And I don't know if it has to do, John, with the early childhood bonding. And, you know, many, 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 many kids never really bonded. And I think there's always that search to bond. And then we get into all these relationship stuff and, you know, seeking that one other witness, that one person that can see me the way I know I need to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's got me thinking, actually, when you say it. Because, I agree. And I think a lot has to do with our outmoded, you know, it is changing now, becoming more conscious, but it's still got a long way to go.
Yeah.
Our outmoded birthing processes, you know, that's one of the very first ways, you know, if you think of the old ways, you know, where we came into the world was really we were met with abuse, first, second, wallop.
Yeah. And then be seen and not heard.
Exactly.
And who do you think you are, you know?
Exactly.
Sit back down. Don't be so, you know, I got sent to my bedroom because I'm coming out with these grandiose ideas, and like, you know, when I remember even saying to my dad, "Oh, Dad, I'm going to New York," and I'm 18 at that time, probably almost 19, and he said, "Oh, just go to your bedroom."
Yeah.
And I said, "No, I am. I'm going to New York, and don't be ridiculous."
Yeah. 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 And the birthing thing is a big one, you know, because I can remember doing a birthing training and. It was a 3-year training, and there was one woman on there who actually had the experience of getting pregnant while she was on the course and going right through her term, and then obviously having the child during the time she was on this course, and then the child was brought into the training as well. But the actual birth procedure that she experienced was she had, you know, 2 or 3 selected people at the birth, and the one thing they did, they all connected consciously with that infant, you know, because... That training was all about making people realize that these newborns were conscious. They were conscious,
right.
You know, and so many of even the medical profession don't really get that.
Mm-hmm.
They're conscious of everything, you know, even in utero.
Yes.
And the result, because we were able to see that child grow up in its early couple of years, was amazing. You know, this child was just amazing. Used to join us on the trainings and was,
mm-hmm.
you know, having fun and was open and...
What a privilege, eh? What a privilege to grow up with that much openness and acknowledgement of that consciousness that you see peering out of the baby's eyes, you know, to let it expand rather than shut down.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
That's it. Yeah, and the ritual that was involved, you know, it's like many of the third world countries, as they call them, you know, they've got so many wonderful rituals that
mm-hmm.
we don't have over here where... They actually had a ritual that welcomed the baby before the baby was actually born, you know, the baby got it because it was in the womb, you know.
Beautiful.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. We've got so much we can learn from some of these, quote, you know, apparent primitive cultures.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I wonder who's really primitive here.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you eventually then got all your team together, and you would have had to do massive renovations and everything else, when did the center first open to the public?
Well, it opened to the public, I would say, within 3 or 4 months. We were literally plumbing in toilets the night before the group came, and we told groups, well, we're not really open yet, but it seemed to have a life of its own. It didn't take, we have never really, you know, advertised. There's been a few articles written, but it just happened right away, John, and we just created more toilets and rooms as we went along. And the renovation, it's been 13 years now, and it is a beautiful sanctuary, and I'd love it to go to its next level. There is a next level. There's, you know, some more buildings and more toilets to be plumbed in. And I do still see the picture is bigger, and it has been an incredible journey of transformation, because to me the thing that I love the most is that process of transformation, whether it's an old chicken coop into the garden cottage or whether it's a person. And I'm watching young teenagers and, you know, people coming here and transforming, and I love that. So it's been rich, John. It's been a rich process of transforming old buildings and people.
Yeah.
Transforming. It's just a place of transformation, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And I feel very privileged and fortunate every day that I'm here.
Yeah, it certainly is, and you've certainly had some transformative experiences down there, haven't you, with people coming and healing, and some of the stories of the people that have come were quite mind-blowing, weren't they?
Really, absolutely. Some people have stayed here that other people said, oh, no, you shouldn't have them there. But, you know, I just in my heart felt that it was okay and it was safe, and there were some fabulous turnarounds for people, some fabulous time, you know, a new reference point. It may not be the whole picture for people, but it gives them a new reference point because it's safe and it's creative and it's a place for them to really get in touch with who they really are, their true nature, through the nature here.
Yeah.
But there was a time, what was it, 2000, John, you know, 1999-2000, where I had another big test. Should I share that?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
So in 1999-2000, I went through an incredible financial nightmare, and I had an investment that of $350,000 that went south. In other words, it was fraudulent, and that money was lost. And that money actually was placed into that thing before getting this land, and that's why. Anyway, I don't need to go into details about that. But the fact is, I was 5 months behind in the mortgage on this retreat center. I had disconnection notices. I had, oh, my God, everything you could imagine, to the point where, you know, my daughter was doing some babysitting to get food money, and Crystal and Deanne were, you know, helping us with food. And I tried to sell things, but nothing would sell. I even, you know, it was just a nightmare, John. I remember I had 2 years of that, and I was 2 years in fear that we were going to lose this retreat center, which we'd spent, we meaning there's a community of people that have helped from the very beginning, and it looked like we were going to lose Xenia and it was going to go back to the bank. And, oh, it was a nightmare. So 2 years of fear, and then it cranked up to 3 months of terror. That's the next movement. So I remember going to bed in terror and waking up in terror, and crying so much and trying desperately to get help and asking everyone, and no one could help, and it was desperate, and it brought me to my knees. And I had all my spiritual practices, and I knew, you know, to trust and this and that and to visualize, but nothing. It was a definite, you know, dark night. So after about 3 months of the terror, I remember I'd walked my daughter up to the school bus, and I came down and I sat on my living room, you know, on the couch, and I just said, okay, it's over. It's over. Take Xenia, take me, take the body. It's done. I cannot sustain this any longer. And what happened was I fell into the terror, and I just let the terror in, because I'd been kind of running from the terror, blocking it, and I just sat and I let it have me, and it was honestly like fire. I felt like I was being like sucked up into this terror, this consuming kind of experience. And that was, I don't know how long it took in terms of time, but it was quite a while. And then I remember it was really silent inside my head, outside. It was really quiet. There was no more, you're going to lose here, you know, nothing, just nothing. And it was like, whoa, peace. And it was like acceptance or something. But the very next day, my girlfriend and I got on the phone, and what seemed to happen was I followed instructions, and it was like, phone these people, do this, do that, and my girlfriend and I got on the phone, and we raised $20,000 of gifted money in 3.5 hours.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought about it, well, how come those people didn't help before? Well, they couldn't, because I was so needy and desperate, and in this terror flap, there was no room for it to come in. But in the surrender and following the instruction, and there was no attachment, there was no whatsoever. It's like if it was no, there's no problem with that. Thank you very much. It was just following instruction. And we raised $20,000. We put it on the mortgage so that it brought the mortgage up to date with the bank. And from that point on, it was like one miracle after another after another. And it's been, you know, several years since that time, and I've never gone back into fear ever since, not in that way. You know, if I do, I sit with it. If I feel anything like fear, or I just sit with it right away, I welcome it, and I give it my full attention. And then it's happy, and it's been met, you know, it's been met with understanding, and it's, you know, it's just a stress-free way of living.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear how you do that, and I don't know, it's so difficult. I find at times, you know, when things aren't moving in the direction that you think they, or you've got planned for them, you know, it's about wondering what the blocks are, you know, what are the blocks, you know, what's blocking them.
Well, that's the mind, eh? The mind wants to know, but really, the only way out is just to surrender into the feeling body, not to put any story on it, you know, not to make it mean anything.
And the thing is, though, Angeline, it's so contrary to what we're trained in this society to do, you know.
Oh, totally.
But Robert Holden saying, you know, when things get really tough and really hard, just do nothing. And that is completely the opposite to how we're trained in our education system, in our higher education, and in work and everything.
Well, as a kid, you know, you start crying or you've got a discomfort or whatever. What do? They stick a lollipop in your mouth, or they bribe you out of crying, or they'll smack you out of crying.
Yeah.
You know, see, we've never been taught to feel our feelings, stuff them, block them. So how could we ever have a real gauge of you know, and I'm not saying that feelings are a gauge of truth, but they are. They're letting us know it's a feedback mechanism.
Exactly.
And unless we meet them at the primary level, then they get blocked in the body, and then they're secondary, and then we have no idea what they're about, but they come out in inappropriate ways later in life, you know?
In disease, you mean?
Yeah, disease and distress.
Yeah.
Addiction.
Yeah. But that concept of absolutely doing nothing, you know, it triggers so much guilt in people, doesn't it? Because
well, they feel guilt.
Yeah, we're taught, you know, you've got to do something.
That's the addiction, you know. But if guilt arises, then sit with guilt.
Yeah.
Whatever's arising, sit with it. We just want to get rid of it. We just want to change it. Like, I don't like this moment. I want the next moment. Well, no, this is what is arising, guilt.
Yeah.
Sit with guilt.
Yeah, I mean, that's so profound and so easily forgotten in the moment, isn't it?
It is, because we can get into automatic, you know, conditioning, and that's what this journey is about, and your call is about, your show is about. It's about awakening.
Yeah.
Getting awake.
And when, in your own spiritual practices, because I think I remember you saying that you came across and you became a student of the Course in Miracles. When did that happen, Angeline?
Yeah, that was quite a long time ago. Probably 10 years ago, I did a whole course in the Course. And there was nothing about it that I ever disagreed with. You know, there was a resonance about it as truth. And that truth deepened and permeated really over time through life experience. And there's been other teachers that have come into my life as well that have reinforced that. So that was a real, you know, like the teachings of Ramesh and some of the Indian teachers, Ram Dass, Eckhart Tolle. Those have been other teachers, but really the message is always the same.
Yeah.
The deeper, you know, and it's so simple, but we really complicate it.
Yeah.
And I love the course because it really, you know, what's the main thing about nothing unreal exists and nothing real can be threatened, something like that.
That's right,
the main famous quote, and that's so true.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is, you know, there is this, oh, God, we just do not perceive. We're not taught how to perceive in school or in life. And unless you're drawn to the spiritual path, we're really caught up into the conditioning.
Yeah, yeah.
And that helps to decondition, you could say.
Yeah. No, and it's fascinating, I've found. I mean, I had the course sitting on my bookshelf since 2000, you know, and kind of dipped in and looked at it. It was far too much like the Bible for me, and kept away from it. But then when that book came out, The Disappearance of the Universe with Gary Renard, that was the one which opened me up to understanding what the course was about, and therefore took me to start studying the course in earnest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it is amazing. And like you said, it is simple, but it's not easy.
Right. I mean, it's actually very... a lot of the understanding the mind cannot actually understand.
No,
because the meaning goes deeper, but the part of us that knows.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then it's about not worrying about understanding every line of the text. Anyway, what I've found, the important thing is doing the lessons.
Exactly.
And stuff happens over the period of time. So.
Yeah.
And have you had any... groups over at Xenia that have run courses in the course, or
over the years, yes, there have been. Well, Dwayne O'Kane and his groups came here in the very beginning before they bought their land, and they were actually quite pivotal in helping us with some of our renovations. They helped us clear the pathway for the labyrinths, and they did a number of programs here before they bought their land in Langley.
Oh, yeah, the Clear Mind.
The Clear Mind group.
Yeah.
And then there were other teachers as well, and a variety of the teachers may not be teaching just the course, but that is the basis of their work. So we have a real eclectic group of people here that come.
Yeah. And what animals have you got at the at Xenia now?
Well, we've got two horses. We did have three, and we lost Sandman last year. He was 34 years old, so he's very, very old, and he had a very good life. And so we have one baby but very big Percheron thoroughbred horse, huge great boy. He's a youngster, 6 years old. And then we have Tango, who is not a horse. Well, he appears as a horse, but I'm not fooled by his cover because he is quite something. And but he is showing up as a horse right now. And then we have a pig. He thinks he's a pig, but he's Charlie.
That's Charlie, yeah. Charlie's a legend on Xenia, isn't he?
He is, and he's definitely a legend in his own mind.
And brings back very happy memories of Doug as well, who was one of the many amazing characters that we met when we were over there.
He was just here this morning. We just had a nice chat this morning, and he came to give porridge to Charlie. And then, of course, the dog and Billy, dog of the year, Billy, and Raj. Raj, our cat. So these animals play quite a part in the sanctuary in that they interact with the people in ways that people just feel like, a connection. A connection to the animal that leads them to a connection with themselves. So it's really sweet when you hear all the stories that come back about, the horse showed up and I was crying and I was sitting on a bench and the horse came over, and I've never been that close to a horse, and it was this massive great thing looking down at me, and it nudged my shoulder forward and put its head down beneath me, and I was like, oh my god, what do I do? But this woman, I'm thinking of this woman in particular, and she said, but I just became, and she had these flip-flop shoes on with her toes, you know, exposed, and there's this massive great horse, and he pulls her shoulder forward and leans his head on her for a moment or two, and she felt herself become really calm.
Yeah.
And then he kind of did a little like that and kind of nodded his head, and off he went. And she's been so impacted by that one experience with that horse. She speaks about it, you know, all the time, how powerful that was for her. And at that time, actually, she was in depression, and she came here depressed, and she came here to try and, you know, get some understanding. And in that moment, it really helped her, the depression, to lift. And as a matter of fact, I've never heard her go back to that place ever since. She's been very up, and her life's growing, and she's had some incredible physical healings. And so these horses, yeah.
They really have had an impact. There's lots of wonderful stories about them. So
yeah.
Well, Angeline, it's we're right up to our time now. It's just flown by. It's been absolutely lovely having you on the show. Wonderful to hear your stories, and we wish you all the success in the growing of Xenia and in everything else you do in your life. You're a great gift to the community and the world at large. And I know Mary and I would definitely look forward to coming over and visiting. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, you're welcome, John, and thanks for having me. It's wonderful to have this chat with you, and I don't know who's all out there in the world listening, but hi to you all, and thanks so much for listening.
That's a pleasure. And your website is www.xeniasanctuary, is it?
It's www.xeniacenter.com, so X-E-N-I-A-C-E-N-T-R-E, like English, center.com.
That's great.
So look us up. And lots of love to you all.
Lots of love to you.
Thanks, John.
Bye, Angeline.
Bye.